Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Orthodox Union Israel Post-Elections Analysis Call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question at that time, please press star one on your touch-tone phone. When your name is called, please state your organization before asking your question. Thank you, Mr. Diamond. Please go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. And this is Nathan Diamond. I'm Executive Director of the Orthodox Union's Advocacy Center. Thank you all for joining us for this call on this historic day after in Israel, and for those of us who care about Israel. We are, as you know, joined by two insightful and articulate observers of the Israeli political scene. And I'll get to them in just a moment. My one commercial advertisement for the purposes of this call is that those of you who were invited onto this call are rabbis and lay leaders throughout the Orthodox community, and we want to take a moment to call your attention to the fact that we're going to be having the Orthodox Union's annual advocacy mission to Washington on June 3rd, in just a couple of months, and all of you who are on this call are very much invited to join us for that day in Washington, which will be a critical day for us to advocate not only for our positions in support of a strong Israel and U.S.-Israel relationship, but also critical domestic policy issues for our community, including securing federal Homeland Security grant funds that benefit so many of our synagogues and schools, securing new legislation for energy grants to make our synagogues and school buildings more energy efficient, and other things on our domestic policy agenda. So I would encourage you all to please go to the OU advocacy section of the OU website and register to join us in Washington on June 3rd for an important and enjoyable day on behalf of our community. That all being said, I want to get right to our presenters and our discussants here, both of whom are very well known in the community. David Horovitz, who is the founding editor-in-chief of the Times of Israel, and Shmuel Rosner, who writes and comments on Israel at the Jewish Journal in Los Angeles, at the International New York Times, and elsewhere. And I want to get right to them for a few opening comments from each of them on the historic election returns from last night, and not just last night, into the wee hours of the morning. And then we'll have some time for Q&A and get some further insights. So, first of all, thank you again, David and Shmuel, for joining us. And I think we said, David, you were going to go first.
Okay, thank you, and pleasure to do the call. I apologize in advance if I'm somewhat incoherent, because like Shmuel, I suspect, and most Israelis who are obsessed with the destiny of our country and the particulars of these elections, I haven't slept much in the last few hours. I actually was going to go to sleep at 3 o'clock this morning, Israel time, when I started registering that the actual election count site, which is rather confusingly presented, nonetheless seemed to show this abiding large lead for the Likud, and so it proved. So I'll try very quickly to say what happened, how it happened, and what's going to happen next in a fast English-accented presentation. What happened is that then Netanyahu won the election. If this was a referendum on Netanyahu, well, you know, Netanyahu has been vindicated, restored, retained. It's a surprise because the momentum in the opinion polls was moving away from him. He was neck and neck 2 weeks ago. He was 4 seats down to Isaac Herzog, although still better placed to form a coalition a week ago. He was neck and neck again in the exit polls when voting ended last night at 10 Israel time. And as I said, when we woke up this morning, or when we continued to be awake all night, it turned out that really he'd had a decisive victory. I think that, first of all, I have no idea if he had more rosy polls himself. I suspect he didn't. I think he thought that the polls in the run-up to the elections were not wildly off. And maybe they weren't. The only thing we can say for certain is that the TV exit polls were wrong. I mean, the vote was not the vote that the TV exit polls called. But were they right or wrong in the run-up to the elections, I don't know. But clearly Netanyahu took some steps to bolster his support. And when I say support, his support, I mean support for the Likud. He went on, I think, an unprecedented blitz of media outreach. He spoke to TV and radio and print media and internet media, and he posted on Facebook. And he had a mantra which is really vote Likud. The one consistent poll finding that was not disproved was that most Israelis want Netanyahu, wanted Netanyahu as prime minister. He was always ahead of Herzog on that single question, which, of course, Israelis don't vote on. But who do you want as prime minister? Well, even in the last poll on Thursday, on Friday for Channel 2, Netanyahu was 8 points clear of Herzog, and he was ahead of Herzog all the way through. And Netanyahu's mantra was, if you want me as prime minister, and apparently most of you do, well, you have to vote Likud, not for any of these satellite right-wing or right-wing-ish parties. You don't have two votes. You don't choose a prime minister and a party. You only choose a party. If you want me, you have to vote Likud. I think that was clearly effective. You can see that he ate into the support for the Jewish home. He probably ate a little bit into the support for Yisrael Beiteinu, and he boosted the Likud, which had 18 seats, 1-8 in the outgoing Knesset, and is looking at 30 in the new Knesset. That's a real rise. So apart from that mantra, he also hardened his positions in order to cement his appeal on the right of the spectrum. He came out against Palestinian statehood. I think he can roll that back if he wants to, but he had previously supported Palestinian statehood in principle with caveats, and he told an internet interviewer on Monday that if he is re-elected, he would not preside over the establishment of a Palestinian state. On election day itself, he caused friction, shall we say, with Israeli Arabs by asserting that a disproportionately high number of them were voting, and therefore his rule was at risk. He then calibrated that a little bit and said it wasn't the fact that they were voting that he objected to, but rather that foreign funding was transporting anyone but Bibi voters to the polls, and therefore potentially skewing the result of the election. And he even took on the incidentally Arab Supreme Court judge who was in charge of the elections and complained that only he was being prevented from speaking directly to the people when the judge prevented the live broadcast of a press conference he had planned. The judge in question happens to be a on-the-record opponent of Israel's archaic election day propaganda laws and also barred a Zionist Union press conference. Again, Netanyahu took those steps to try and cement the vote for him and essentially, therefore, for the Likud. And all of those factors added to whatever the starting position was and whatever we make of those polls led to the result that we now see, which is a decisive, by Israeli standards, victory for Netanyahu and a really striking rise in support for the Likud. In terms of the coalition, I don't think he's going to have a particularly easy time putting together a coalition, but the coalition that seems certain to take shape is one of the right wing and the Haredi parties. He doesn't want Zionist Union or Yesh Atid in his coalition, and I think the feeling is mutual. And that's a bit of a departure, remember, because Netanyahu has liked to be at the center of his own coalitions with parties to his left and right, the better to present himself as trying to steer a pragmatic course. But he called these elections because he became utterly frustrated with Yesh Atid and with Tzipi Livni. Now his realistic coalition is a coalition of the right-wing parties and the Haredi parties, which, of course, we should bear in mind, are the very parties whose support he cannibalized, and three of which are led by disgruntled people who used to work for him, Avigdor Lieberman, Naftali Bennett, and Moshe Kahlon. So it's not going to be sort of happiness and joy and unity there, but that is the apparent only remotely probable coalition. Might not take shape as quickly as one might think. And then very briefly in terms of fallout, he said to me in one of his many outreaches to journalists that it would not take a great leap of the imagination to believe that the Obama administration wanted to see the back of him. I don't think that they would have been celebrating in the White House. I don't know how that's going to play out. I don't know if he's going to try and reach out in some kind of way to ease relations with the president, who of course, he openly lobbied against, really. with that speech in Congress. He lobbied against the deal with Iran that, that the president is championing. And I don't know, to be honest, how that's going to play out. Will the United States now try to compel new progress on the Palestinian front? We wait to see. Will it take different positions at dramatic diplomatic standoffs? Might it act differently in the UN? We wait to see. On the Palestinian front, I don't see much prospect of progress in a negotiated setting, but of course I don't think the Palestinians are, in fact I think the Palestinians are demonstrably unwilling to take positions that Israel could live with in a substantive peace process, but I foresee considerably more friction between Israel and the Palestinians, a great deal of international pressure on this issue, difficulties there. And lastly, I think it's worth bringing this to internal Israel. I think the consensual mood in Israel, and you asked me this as we started, Nathan, is shock. Israelis are shocked by the results of these elections because they weren't the results that they were anticipating. It's shock and delight among Netanyahu's supporters, and it's shock and dismay among a substantive minority who did not want to see Netanyahu re-elected. And the question, I think, or one of the big questions now, is what Netanyahu does. Having won an election with unsurprisingly, a very strikingly partisan approach and appeal to voters, he's now the prime minister of all of Israel with a coalition that's probably not going to represent the consensus or far across the consensus in Israel. And really, one of the questions, and one of, I think, the challenges for Netanyahu will be to somehow move away from the partisan frenzy of the final days of the campaign and try to reach out further across the Israeli electorate. I don't know if he's minded to do that. I'm not sure he's going to have a coalition that's going to really want him to do that. And there is, you know, potential real friction within Israel. And these widely different moods that this election result finds as a consequence of how this has played out.
Great. Thank you, David. And let's go to Shmuel.
Okay. Hello, everybody. Thank you for having me on this call. Since I, with everything said, I'll try not to repeat any of it. And I'll try to focus my remarks on several notes. I'll begin where David ended his comments with Prime Minister Netanyahu. Netanyahu miraculously and single-handedly turned this election around in the last three days of the campaign. I've never seen such amazing performance by an Israeli politician. Essentially did it, and this is a characteristic of Netanyahu that we see repeatedly. He's the three-time prime minister, now elected for a fourth term. Insider of insiders of Israeli politics, and still, he ran this election as an insurgent, as an outsider. He was running against a powerful establishment. He was running against a powerful media that was haunting him. He was running against foreign intervention, great powers that are trying to topple him. He was running against President Obama and his allies. Netanyahu, even though he came into this election as the prime minister and the essential favorite to win this election, in the last days of the campaign, realized that he might lose, and then turned to his basic instincts as a politician, to beat the insurgent, to run from the outside, to run against the system. We see it, if to use one example, you can see it in an insignificant incident that happened two or three weeks ago when Netanyahu, in a move that was not truly elegant, essentially canceled the Israel Prize for Literature for this year by deciding not to approve the committee that was already appointed for the purpose of giving this prize. And he spoke to me on the day after his decision, And he said, "Well, I've had enough of this. Of this, you know, it's all a clique of people, a group of people from the far left who give prizes to one another. And I'm going to end this. I'm going to change the system." And he was talking as if the system was not a system that he controls for many of the last 20 years. So Netanyahu the insurgent is one theme of this election that I think is very powerful. Second note is about Yitzhak Herzog, the leader of the Zionist camp. It is true that Herzog for a while seemed as if he can win this election, he can pull it off, and can get more seats in the next Knesset than his rival Netanyahu. But truth must be told, for Herzog, the math towards getting to 61 seats in the Knesset was always complicated. Even last Friday, when we thought that it is the Zionist camp is going to come on top with a gap of 5 or 6 or even 7 seats in the Knesset, even then, when we looked at numbers, not of specific parties, but of the blocks, the political blocks, it was always a complicated math for him to get to 61. It was always clear that he will need to provide some kind of miracle. First, he needs to win the election. Then he needs to convince President Rivlin to give him the mandate to try and form a coalition. And even then, he'd still have a very long road for him to be able to convince different parties who already declared that they will not sit with one another in this coalition. It will be very difficult for him to get to the majority of 61. So I don't think it was truly in the cards for Herzog to become the prime minister. Maybe possibly under an arrangement of a unity government in which he gets to go second in a rotation arrangement and get the last 2 years of the term if the government survives. One note about the next coalition. The next coalition is really the only viable, possible coalition coming out of this election. It is true that it's going to be a fairly narrow coalition of right-wing and religious parties. It is true that it will not always be convenient for Netanyahu to lead this coalition, and it is true that there is some friction built into this coalition before it was even formed. However, trying to form any other coalition for Israel would probably fail, and the only real alternative to having this coalition when we consider the outcome of this election is if Israel wants to go immediately for another round of election. That's why I think Netanyahu does hold an important card when he goes into negotiations with his potential partners. It is true that that the partners, such as the former minister Moshe Kahlon, the head of the Kolanu party, you know, without Kahlon, Netanyahu does not have a coalition. But truly, can Kahlon refuse an offer from Netanyahu when the alternative is sending Israel into another round of election? I'm not sure Kahlon truly has an alternative to accepting Netanyahu's offer. Of course, assuming that the offer will be a fairly generous one and not an insulting offer. Now, a couple of notes on things that people don't always pay attention to and are of some importance. First, the turnout. Turnout for this election was the highest since 1999. It was almost 72% voters that went to the polls. The tight race that the polls presented to the voters last Friday drove voters into the polling places in great numbers. And I think it is important for Israel to reverse a trend, a disturbing trend of decline in the number of people that voted in recent elections and turned it around, and having so many Israelis voting is really a celebration for Israel's democracy. Couple more things. The number of women in the next Knesset is going to be the highest ever for Israel. We are going to have 8 female members in the Knesset for the next term. 10 years ago, in 2006, we had only 17 female members of Knesset. So this is a significant advancement in the representation of women in the legislative body of Israel. Thirdly, Arab representation in the Israeli Knesset, again, is going up in this election. I'm not going to go into detail in discussing the United Arab Party that came about this election, but it is important to realize that Arab representation in the Knesset is going up from 12 in the last Knesset to 17 in the next term, not all of the members of the United Arab Party. Of course, the question with Arab Knesset members is the question of which approach they are going to take. Are they going to take an approach of engagement with Israeli society, an approach of cooperation and integration for their constituency into its society? With 17 Knesset members, surely they can achieve something for their voters. However, we have to acknowledge the fact that in many previous instances, many of the members representing the Arab minority preferred an approach of contrarian politics. They preferred to deal with the Palestinian issue, with criticizing Israel, criticizing Zionism, criticizing Israel as a Jewish state, trying to be a disruptive force in Israel's politics rather than a constructive force in helping their constituencies better integrate into the Israeli society. This point, and I think this will be an important, interesting point for this group, is the significant drop in Orthodox representation in the next Knesset. The number of members representing Orthodox parties significant. The last Knesset, we have 39 members of Knesset that were identified as Orthodox, religiously Orthodox. In the next Knesset, the number is be reduced by 12. We will have 27 such members of Knesset. You have to realize that the religious parties were fell victim to the blitz of Prime Minister Netanyahu. Prime Minister Netanyahu, in his last attempt, last possibly desperate attempt to get more voters to vote for Likud, save the right-wing majority, he appealed to religious voters, and as a consequence, the Habayta Yehudi party, the Jewish Home Party, went down to only 8 seats in the next Knesset, and the two ultra-Orthodox parties, Shas and United Torah Judaism, are also, well, especially Shas, declined in the next term. So the representation for Orthodox groups in Israel is going to go down, even though these parties are all going to be part of the next coalition and possibly will have lesser representation but more political power within the next Netanyahu coalition. I'll end on that note.
Thank you, Shmuel. We're having a little trouble on your phone. I don't know if it's because of where you are. Maybe I don't know if the operator, if it makes sense for you to redial him. But in the meantime, We'll ask for questions. The operator will give you instructions in terms of how to queue in for questions. And while that's going on, I will ask just one more question of our speakers.
Once again, to ask an audio question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phones. When your name is called, please state your organization before asking your question.
Great. So while people are queuing up, I guess I'll just throw back a question with regard to Kyle Roan. So what do you think, you know, very briefly, because we want to get to other people's questions, what do you think he wants? What's his ticket price for giving Netanyahu more than 60 seats? And second, although not necessarily related, do you have any idea who do you think is likely for Netanyahu to name as foreign minister? David, why don't you go first?
Kahlon has you know, said throughout the campaign that he would support whichever head of potential coalition was ready to advance what he calls the socio-economic agenda. He has campaigned to be the finance minister. He's the only head of a mainstream party who made it overt that he did not wish to become the prime minister. It was quite ironic because he's probably the least offensive party leader to the other party leaders and to their voters, and therefore he was quite an attractive consensus candidate. He didn't actually run a particularly good campaign, in my opinion. I think he could have done much better, but he still did pretty well. He wants to be finance minister, and he wants a government that will follow an agenda that will make life easier financially for working class and lower middle class Israelis. His much trumpeted achievement was that he cut the cost of mobile phone use in Israel. He broke the monopolies. He presents himself as a sort of tycoon busting politician looking after the common man. And in Israel, with a growing gulf between haves and have-nots, with a high cost of living, with soaring housing prices, which for him is a very, very big issue, by the way, that's the agenda he wants to follow. So he'll demand that job, and he'll seek political positions, policies, legislation to advance that agenda. In terms of who Netanyahu is going to make the foreign minister, you know, I think it's a little bit early to speculate. It seems to me quite possible that Netanyahu might want to keep that in the Likud. There'd be no shortage of people within the Likud who would be very happy to take that job. He's got a lot of negotiating to do. Although, you know, on the one hand, he's won this election. Nobody else can form a coalition under remotely conceivable circumstances. On the other hand, it's a fractious group of rather annoyed party leaders, who, you know, as I said in my opening remarks, many of whom he really directly confronted. He told the voters not to vote for them, in some cases quite explicitly. And therefore, like-minded though they may be in many of their broad political outlooks, they're not going to come easy. I certainly agree with Shmuel. I don't think there's anywhere else for them to go. But they'll try and drive a bargain. But you know, Netanyahu, I think you if you conclude anything from the way the election has played out, is that he's a very effective politician, and you wouldn't bet against him building a coalition pretty much the way he wants it. However, he broke up this coalition, and he called these elections because the last group of parties were supposedly working with him. Well, he just couldn't do it anymore. The coalition did not function. And I'm not sure that it's going to be a great deal easier with the next group.
Okay, let's go to the question queue. Thank you.
Your first question comes from the line of Joel Schoenfeld.
Yes, my question is regarding the polls and the pollsters. They were stunningly wrong, and even the exit polls were stunningly wrong. The question is, and I hear speculation that perhaps the pollsters in Israel come with an agenda, specifically a leftist agenda. Is that possible, that they're wrong due to a biased agenda, that they're so wrong?
I'll go on this. I don't know if Shmuel, are you still there? Or
yes,
if we're trying
I'm
to get
here.
Shmuel on.
Shmuel, why don't you take that one?
Yeah, I'd be happy to take it. This is the point in which I need to say that some of my best friends are pollsters. I don't think they are driven by political agenda. I think pollsters in Israel face some specific problematic question they have to deal with. People have to remember that unlike the American system in which there are only two parties, in Israel there are many parties and many Jewish voters. In America, Jewish voters are only 2% of the population. In Israel, it's almost all of the population, and Jewish voters tend to have a lot of information about the election, but tend to make up their minds at the last minute. It is true that the failure of polls in this election was notable, but we have to separate two issues here. There is the failure of the early polls to give us a clear picture of the final outcome, but that can be because of the change in the opinions of voters in the last couple of days. Last Friday, when we had the latest polls before pollsters were forbidden by law to publish more polls until Election Day, in the last 3 days of the campaign, it is forbidden in Israel to publish any polls. So the latest polls were last Friday, and then you could see that there was a gap favorable to the Labor Party, but you could also see that between 20 and 25% of voters said that they didn't yet make up their minds. So the last 3 days of the campaign that were highly intensive might have changed their minds or might have made them vote for the Likud party and hence shifted the ground and changed the outcome of the election. The failure of the exit polls is more complicated to explain. One explanation that I heard this morning from a notable Israeli pollster, Professor Camille Fuchs, is that he thought, and this is interesting, he thought that there were many Likud voters refusing to participate in the exit poll. The exit poll is voluntary. People are getting out of the polling booth. They are asked to participate, and some of them agree and some don't. What pollsters didn't realize is that the number of people who are Likud voters that refused to participate in the exit polls was markedly high, and he attributes this phenomenon to the fact that many Likud voters were angry with the media. They thought that the media was after Netanyahu, that the media treated the prime minister in an unfair manner. They were, and that's why they refused to participate in the exit polls, and hence the whole concept of the exit polls in all three television channels was skewed. All three channels came with about the same number, and all of them could not see that the number of Likud voters participating in the polls were just much too low for them to be accurate.
Great. Thank you. Let's go to the next question.
Your next question is from Benjamin Blau.
Hi, thank you for our two experts. I'm just wondering what you think Netanyahu is going to do on the economic front. I know that one of the big issues in the last coalition was the issue of how to treat the religious parties, and we have that interesting dichotomy. The religious parties have gotten smaller, and yet at the same degree their influence may have grown. So I'm wondering how that's going to match up with, on the one hand, Kahlon's desire to really improve the working class Israelis' status, and how that's going to match up with the real economic challenges, where the two largest blocks of groups that are fastest growing and have the most dire economic straits are, of course, the Israeli Arabs and the Haredi communities. So what do you think Netanyahu's economic plan will be to do with those situations moving forward?
David, do you want to take that?
Well, I don't have anything particularly brilliant to say. I think that Kahlon will want to have a central role. There'll be ultra-Orthodox Haredi components in the coalition. One of the consequences of legislation that everybody has hated, and therefore maybe it isn't so bad, on raising the proportion of young Haredi males going into the army, is that there's been a rise in entry to the workforce, and that's pretty crucial for a sector of the demographic that's that finds economic conditions untenable. I definitely think he's going to have to address it. I think, you know, I've seen interpretations of this election result which suggest that it was, in fact, it wasn't about socioeconomic issues. It was all about security and Iran and the Palestinians. I think any categorical assertion that one issue or another determine these elections is mistaken. I think things are much more complicated. But there's no doubt that lots of Israelis are hurting financially, that people even in non-most troubled sectors, leaving aside Israeli Arabs, leaving aside the Haredi community, general Israelis with families with two breadwinners in reasonable employment have a hard time getting through the month. Netanyahu is aware of that. In Netanyahu's mini mea culpas in the final days of the campaign, he said, you know, I didn't handle the housing issue with sufficient attention. I didn't prioritize it. We're going to have to work at this. We're going to have to do better. He must be feeling, you know, spectacularly vindicated, but I don't think that will engender a sense that he can ignore issues that are clearly on the agenda. I just want to add one more little thing about the last question, because I love the last question and the question of the polls. What we lack from Israeli pollsters, and we are to blame if we didn't highlight this, is there's no humility. You get no sense from the pollsters that they are anything other than infallible, and that's the problem. Not that they get stuff wrong. When you look at it, you know, they're not a million miles away, but when you're even a little bit off in an Israeli election where the arithmetic is critical, where two or three seats in either direction remake the balance of power, when you've got 10 or 11 parties that are realistically competing for places in the Knesset, when you've raised the threshold and therefore you're in uncharted territory, when the Arab parties have unified and you're in uncharted territory, when there are so many factors working against you, there should have been lots of caveats. Here's what we think. Don't take our word for it. We can't be sure. This is just an estimation. Nobody should rely on none of that. Quite the reverse. Grandiose, dramatic music. You know, the election was over at 10 o'clock. You could all go to sleep. Except that it wasn't, and you couldn't.
Thank you. Next question.
If I may just add a few words about the economic issue, and I'll just say something regarding the participation of Haredis in the workforce and in military service. I think that the approach taken by the previous government is an approach that Prime Minister Netanyahu did not like to begin with. It was a confrontational approach led by former finance minister Yair Lapid, who made a name for himself by trying to fight Haredi influence in Israel. Prime Minister Netanyahu knows that integration of more Haredis into the workforce is essential for Israel's economy, and he does understand that participation in the military is also essential if Israelis are to integrate the Haredi community into the larger society. However, the approach that Netanyahu prefers, and he's not the only one who has that approach. You get the same tune if you speak about this issue to Defense Minister Moshe Yaalon, who's in charge of military service. They much prefer a more conciliatory approach to these affairs. They say and they feel, and they have the data to prove it, that the Haredi community is changing from within, and they think that such changes should be cultivated in ways other than punishments and threats and sanctions. And they believe that by doing this gradually and in a more conciliatory way, they can achieve better results than if they take the more confrontational approach. We are definitely going to see changes to the legislation of the recent government or of the recent Knesset on the military draft. Some of the harsher segments or parts of the legislation, some of the sanctions are going to be removed from the books. And this will, you know, whether this will increase, decrease, or not change at all the participation of Haredis in the workforce and in the military service, we'll have to wait and see.
Thank you. Next question, operator.
Your next question comes from Stephen Tenenbaum.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for that expert opinion. I did join the call a little late, so pardon me if this was covered. Prime Minister Netanyahu made a very radical statement regarding peace talks with the Palestinians, the creation of a Palestinian state, just a few days ago. So is that just politicking? Does he mean it? And what impact will that have on the peace process going forward?
This is David Horowitz. I did mention it briefly. I don't know that I have many more brilliant things to say, but I'll just restate. This was something he said. He said, he was asked. He said, that the current climate in the Middle East is such that when you relinquish territory, Islamic extremists fill the vacuum, and it's just not something that's tenable at the moment. And then he was asked, does that mean that under your watch, if you're reelected, there won't be a Palestinian state established? And he said, indeed. I think he would rather like to recalibrate that a little bit. I'm sure some of his coalition partners won't want him to. He doesn't want Israel to become a binational state. He does think that a full sovereign Palestinian state is not something that Israel dare partner towards the establishment. There's a pretty wide body of opinion in Israel. It extends beyond the right that Mahmoud Abbas is, to put it mildly, a very problematic partner, and he's the relative moderate compared to Hamas, who are avowedly committed to destroying Israel. So the potential for him to walk this back a little bit in principle, I think, is there. Substantively, I think things are very bleak on that front. In any case, and I'll just refer you to something which I think is quite interesting, which is the head of the Arab League a couple of hours ago said that he did not think that this was a statement that should be taken too seriously. He ascribed it to Israeli electioneering. So quite something when the Arab League is unfazed by a potentially quite dramatic statement by the Prime Minister.
But just, let me just follow up with that a second. Do you think besides that, the modulation that you just suggested he might be able to do, is there something that could – is there an aspect of that that could come out in sort of the coalition negotiations or, again, who's going to be the foreign minister, things along those lines that are a little bit more nuts and bolts?
No, I don't think so, because I think if we're looking at the coalition that we anticipate taking shape here, there's not going to be anyone pushing him towards the center. And therefore, it will be up to him. What I think is possible is, I think we may see a great deal of international pressure on Israel, and we may see a great deal of American pressure on Israel. And, a lot of people have been critical of these elections and critical of Netanyahu as some kind of for fear mongering, which is a very easy word to throw out there, but can be explained in many ways, and a superficial explanation is not the right one. Israelis are pretty worried about this region. We are 9 miles wide at our narrowest point. We are on the western edge of a hostile landmass, as I know all of you know. When Israel left Gaza, Hamas took over. When Israel left southern Lebanon, Hezbollah took over. The precedents for relinquishing territory are hardly encouraging for Israelis far beyond the traditional Israeli right. And if I was speaking in a call to the American administration and the leadership of the international community, I would be saying, don't just accuse Netanyahu of fear-mongering as though he's whipped up otherwise sanguine Israelis into a frenzy of concern. Internalize that Israelis are genuinely concerned. We were being blown up in our buses and our shopping malls 10 years ago. Hamas took over Gaza and it fires rockets at us. Hezbollah has 10 times the rocket power. Maybe internalize that it's a pretty threatening neighborhood, and internalize that Israelis are not idiots and that some of this vote can be ascribed to some real, profound Israeli concerns. I fear that that's not the way it's going to play out. I fear there might be a great deal of pressure on Israel, but that's the environment in which it will be received in Israel. This election underlines, it does lots of things, but among them it underlines that Israelis are genuinely fairly concerned about this region and want a leader, at least some of them do, want a leader who they feel can robustly resist that kind of pressure, and not enough of them plainly were convinced that Isaac Herzog would be able to pilot the correct course amid those conflicting pressures.
Let's try to get in a couple more questions before we have to wrap up.
Okay.
Yeah. Your next question comes from Fabian Schoenfeld.
Yes, in regard to the Palestinian state business, why don't we point out that Abbas himself has said weeks ago and several times, in the Palestinian state, no Jews will be allowed to live. That's never been tackled properly.
Shmuel, all yours.
Well, I'll add one note to what David just said about the pressures put on Israel and the situation Netanyahu might find himself getting into. One of the things I worry about when it comes to forming a right-wing coalition in Israel is that when we think about the regional situation, the volatile situation that Israel might find itself having to face or having to deal with, the narrower the coalition, the more right-wing the coalition is perceived, not just by the world, but also by Israelis, the less Israelis are going to accept the measures that the government might need to take against Israel's enemies. In other words, if Netanyahu needs to convince the world or to convince fellow Israelis that he need to take measures against an enemy, it will be much more difficult for him to do it with the next government, with a right-wing coalition, than it used to be for him when to his left he had Tzipi Livni and Yair Lapid, and they were supportive of these measures. In that regard, when the next Israeli government is forced to use force or to take harsh measures against enemies, it is going to be very complicated, not just when... internal dynamics within Israeli society.
Shmuel, I think we're losing your phone line.
Oh, can you hear me now?
Yeah, but it's kind of on and off.
So I was saying it'll be more complicated for Netanyahu, not just with international pressure, but also internally to use measures against Israel's enemies and get the support of all Israelis when he only relies within his coalition on right-wing parties.
Okay, let's get in another question, please.
You have no further audio questions.
Okay, I'll just give people one more chance to queue in if they do want to ask a question. I will make my commercial advertisement one more time, especially for those who got on the call late, which is those of you who are invited onto this call are leaders in the OU or in OU-affiliated shuls and schools, we are having our advocacy day in Washington, D.C. on June 3rd. And we will be advocating for Israel and her welfare and security, as well as key domestic policy initiatives, including homeland security funds and energy efficiency funds and other things for our shuls and schools. We really hope that as many of you on this call will go to our website and register to join us here in Washington on June 3rd. Is there one last question that people want to ask? Operator, is anybody else queued in?
You have no further questions.
Okay. Any concluding comments you would like to make, David or Shmuel? Then we'll wrap it up.
I'll just say very briefly, it's good to speak to you. It's never dull. we had thought that really I had said, you know, I thought the second electorate would prove very critical. That's the party leaders now going off to the president to recommend who should form the next coalition. It seems as though that will be less critical. It seems there can really only be one prime minister, and it seems as though there can, broadly speaking, only be one coalition. But I think we're still in for some pretty arduous negotiations. And I, you know, I'll be foolish enough to speculate. You know, I'm not convinced that the next coalition, even though it might be less diverse ideologically, is going to be particularly easy to manage either. I wouldn't be too surprised if long before the scheduled end of term of this next Israeli parliament, we're not doing this all over again.
Well, I hope you'll get some sleep before then. Shmuel, any last comments?
I'll just say that when David talks about the road ahead, it doesn't mean it'll take days. It usually takes long weeks before Israel can form a coalition. I'd say it'll probably take 4 to 6 weeks before we see a coalition emerging from these negotiations. And I think that, you know, for the participants in this call, as Americans, the road ahead when it comes to relations between the two governments, the Israeli government and the American government, is going to be a rocky one, at least in the next 2 years when President Obama is still in office. And I think that this might present leaders of the American Jewish community with some inconvenient moments that they'd have to deal with along this road.
Okay, well, I'm going to try to follow in our tradition and try to end things on an optimistic note as opposed to that one, which is to say, if nothing else, we, and I hope many others around the world, can once again appreciate today that Israel is a democracy, and not only a democracy, but a robust, vibrant, pluralistic democracy, and that just that in and of itself, having gone through this very intense debate where there were real issues at stake, and who knows how many, tens of thousands of, well, you do know, more than 70% of Israelis coming out to vote in that process, is something that I think on a fundamental level we should all be very proud of. So thank you again to David and Shmuel for sharing your insights with us. Thank you all around the country for calling in, and have a wonderful day.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.